Part 5 of Healing the Inner Child by Grantley Morris of netburst.net. In an attempt to keep secret their crime, abusers with occult knowledge sometimes deliberately transfer a demon to their victims to keep alters too terrorized reveal themselves, and the abuse they suffered. Even when this occurs, it might not apply to all the alters a person has. For example, once a person learns how to split, further splits could occur in response to new traumas after the original abuser has left. Of course, if any alters are suppressed by demons, those alters are free to reveal themselves once the demons are ejected. Even though the above was not the specific reason, I know several people who discovered they have alters only after being delivered from demons. Not only are alters not demons, confusing them with demons could prove disastrous. Nevertheless, we are about to see that, especially with some alters, many things make them disturbingly easy to mistake for demons. The three main reasons are that before alters begin to heal. 1. Some can seem evil. 2. They can give themselves bizarre names. 3. They themselves can be confused about their identity. Let's explore this. Early contact with an alter is likely to be unpleasant, because this is when an alter is most raw and hurting. Some alters even choose to test whether they will be rejected by deliberately acting offensive in their initial contact. Others can do nasty things in a frantic attempt simply to break out of their isolation and get their host to listen to them. An alter once seemed to try to seduce me. She later admitted that she had observed my moral standards with her host before she revealed herself, and she was actually trying to offend me by her apparent seduction, because she expected that I'd reject her, and she thought she might as well get the rejection over with. On the other hand, great integrity is needed when relating to alters, because they can be so desperate for love and approval, as to be tempted to do almost anything to obtain it. We have noted that when alters first make their presence felt, they are likely to have been cut off from many years of developments in their host's life. Alters that formed before a person became a Christian, or when the person was backslidden, are therefore likely to have been cut off from exposure to the gospel, and know nothing of a living relationship with Christ. So we can expect them to act like non-Christians. Moreover, alters have suffered almost beyond the realms of human endurance. So it should not surprise, if in their attempt to cope with severe suffering, they gained an undesirable addiction, or are filled with hate or rage because they misinterpreted their misfortune as abandonment by God, or they use strong language to forcefully express their pain or pent-up anger and frustration. Any of the factors so far mentioned are enough for alters to act in a manner that is out of character for the host person, as he or she is today, and for such alters to superficially seem demonic. Even more confusing, is that alters can give themselves names that anyone not experienced with alters might assume would be the exclusive domain of demons. In the examples given throughout this presentation, almost all the spirit-inspired quotes from an alter are from one who originally called herself Reject. A sister alter called herself Pain, another, Failure, and another, who felt so rejected by God that she wanted to set herself up as her own God, called herself Divinity. I have yet to come across alters that assume the name Evil or Devil, but such names seem quite likely, given the strong tendency of abusers to keep authoritatively telling their young, impressionable victims that they are evil. In the battle not to mistake an alter for a demon, it is confusing enough finding alters who hate God, act in nasty ways that, for the host person, is out of character, and give themselves bizarre names, but it is made even worse by many alters doubting or denying their humanity. It is common for alters to yearn to be human, but to have doubts about whether they really are. Part of this is because they were formed as a result of abuse in which they were treated as objects, rather than as humans who had feelings and a will of their own. Also, to dull their pain, many altars have blocked off almost all feeling, and this can make them feel less than human. On the other hand, some altars do not want to be human. One altar who kept telling me she was not human, revealed that she did not want to be human because humans feel, and are thus exposed to feeling pain, and humans must cope with their sexuality. She feared she was gay, and in any case, to her, sex meant abuse. She added that if she were human, she would have to relate to other humans, and so be exposed to the possibility of rejection. Ironically, this altar was highly offended by the thought of anyone mistaking her for a demon, and unlike demons, who like living in human bodies, she wanted to leave Earth completely, and live in her imaginary spaceship. We must remember that fantasy can be a powerful way of escaping an intolerable reality, and that children are both highly imaginative and impressionable. It would be easy to mistake for a demon an altar who kept insisting he was a dog. I have spoken to such an altar. The man with this altar was traumatized as a child by being sexually molested by a dog. The altar hated what had happened, and concluded that only a dog could be treated that way. On a more positive side, when we consider children's love of animals, and the peaceful lives that animals often seem to have, it should not surprise us that, in a desperate attempt to feel safe and escape the reality of their suffering, some altars might choose to convince themselves that they are animals. And given the alienation that abused children often feel, or their longing to escape human suffering, some might choose to convince themselves that they are aliens, fairies, monsters, or some other mythical being. Recently, an altar told me of a brother altar who believed he was a bear. As is common for recently surfaced altars, Bear, as he called himself, was too shy to speak, but was listening. So I began gently speaking to him. I had assumed he had chosen to believe he was a bear to help himself feel safe, since few people would dare mess with a grizzly bear. After I spoke to him along those lines for a few moments, he interrupted, saying that he was not an animal, but was a tattered teddy bear, because, he said, stuffed toys can't feel. It is common for hurting altars to feel disconnected from their feelings, and of course, anyone who is hurting would prefer to feel unable to feel pain. In seeking comfort, certain altars might assume a false identity. Their suffering and memories, however, are real. In the light of what we have so far discovered, it is not hard to conceive of some altars mistakenly supposing they are demons. A common reason is the low self-esteem of altars, coupled with the fact that abusers often do their utmost to brainwash their victims into thinking that these innocents are evil, or of the devil. I have also heard of one altar, formed in exceptional circumstances, who thought he was a demon. In this case, abusers were trying to plant a real demon in the person, and having an altar capable of giving a convincing impression of a demon having been successfully planted, was a clever way of foiling the abuser's evil intention. These exceptions aside, however, altars usually appear as human, whereas demons only sometimes pretend to be human. Demons are external beings that might enter a person and mess with one's mind, but they are no more part of the person than a leech is. Despite it being easy to mistake some altars for demons, altars could no more be cast out than anyone's past experiences and memories could be cast out. And because every altar has deep feelings and sensitivities, and is as much a person as the host is, how an altar is treated is critical. You cannot drive altars out, but you can drive altars in, forcing them deeper into a person, where they hide, reeling in the pain of being grossly misunderstood, and unwilling to risk further contact with people, even with people who have great potential to help. Usually within just a few days of contact with a loving, accepting person, an altar will begin to heal and feel more peace, and so become increasingly delightful to converse with. Even altars that initially seem obnoxious can quickly become devoted, spirit-filled Christians, deeply in love with Jesus, and highly moral. Tragically, however, some counselors or hosts can be so hasty in misjudging altars as demons, that altars withdraw in terror before these self-proclaimed experts or hosts have a chance to truly interact with them, and discover how loving, spiritually enlightened and authentically Christian, altars can become. It would be upsetting enough for someone to believe you have a demon, but consider how offended would you feel were someone to believe you are a demon. To further understand why altars panic and go into deep hiding if labeled supernaturally evil, it is critical to keep in mind, it will become even clearer as you keep reading, that altars are usually already hurting immensely, and highly sensitive to perceived rejection, and fear that their former abusers' slanderous insults, that they are evil and worthless, might be true. Even worse, counselors who fail to distinguish between demons and altars, slip into the delusion that an altar falling into gut-wrenching silence means they have cast out a demon, thus inspiring these well-meaning, but tragically mistaken helpers to continue their reign of terror on other innocent victims. Counselors who don't even believe in demons, but refuse to accept the reality of altars, can have a similar, dangerously negative effect. On the other extreme, it is possible for altars who don't seem demonic, to actually be demons. Jesus told my friend Lily that two of her altars were demons. Neither of us had got to know these two well, they had only recently revealed themselves, but I was shocked. I had received three brief emails from one of them, and detected absolutely nothing to suggest it was a demon. Lily thought back over every time she had seen these imposters, and could recall no time when she had seen either of them in close proximity to Jesus. Lamentably, because of abusers who claim to have God on their side, or even dress up as Jesus while hurting their victims, it is not uncommon for altars to initially be terrified of Jesus. To counter this, Lily has developed a system whereby altars can access memories willingly shared by other altars, and top priority in the things to show new altars, is a collection of memories of beautiful encounters various altars have had with Jesus. Obviously, this helps recent arrivals understand that the real Jesus is safe. Lily has learned not to fear demons. But now that Lily knows it is possible for demons to pretend to be altars, she tests for imposters this way. As soon as a traumatized altar stabilizes, she tests the supposed altar by calling in Jesus, and observing how he and the new one interact. If altars began to make their presence felt in you, fears, feelings and battles with temptation would probably resurface that you had thought you were over, but had actually been plaguing you for years, in less obvious ways, and for reasons you couldn't identify. To the untrained person, this reactivation of unpleasant feelings and ungodly desires might seem undesirable, but in reality it is the best thing that could ever happen. It is like a person finally discovering the cause of the poor health he has endured for years, and learning that through surgery he can enjoy health like he has never before known. Ignorance might seem like bliss, because it delays the pain of surgery, but it is actually a curse, because it keeps the person below full health. An inner voice was making all sorts of false accusations against Alice. By this time, Alice and I had had considerable experience with altars. Not only was this voice not one of her 25 altars that we had identified, it seemed quite different to any altar we had ever encountered. In fact, no new altars had surfaced in Alice for quite some time, and we expected that there were no more. Along with some of Alice's discerning altars, I was fairly sure that the source of this hate and false accusations was a demon. Nevertheless, I decided to be cautious. Rather than aggressively rebuke it as a demon, I compromised by gently affirming that Alice belonged to Jesus, and that because she had his righteousness, no accusations applied to her. Although I affirmed the truth, I wondered if I were being a wimp for not getting more aggressive. The voice, however, soon turned out to be an alter who said she hated both God and Alice, and sometimes wanted to kill people. This was just because she was deeply hurting. She called herself accused because she had taken on board all the false accusations that had been hurled at her. In fact, she was so sensitive that she sometimes took even innocent remarks as accusations. Even though I had been unaware of this altar, she had become aware of me, and thought warmly towards me. Imagine the damage I would have caused had I added to this altar's near-suicidal state, by falsely accusing her of being demonic. Because I didn't make that mistake, the altar quickly healed. She discovered that God loved her, and all her hate and bitterness left. It should be becoming progressively clearer to you why, in the early stages of dealing with an altar, when he or she has had little chance to heal, it is tempting to despise the altar. Rather than joyfully embrace the healing opportunity, we can react like a sick person who thinks he would prefer the illness he is familiar with, over the unknown pain and dangers of surgery. Naturally, while a person is recovering from surgery, he may temporarily feel worse than ever, but now, for the first time, full healing is on its way. People with alters have the same assurance that, despite initial discomfort, things will get better when they let Jesus minister to their alters.